Actually now it is recording. I can edit this further on, so there's no big problem. We'll have to do it just that way, that I don't want to waste your time further on, so we'll continue from the second exercise, and after I've done the sect, I have to do the first read the first exercise through again on my own. And hopefully, Alexandra, you remind me of this again, because I might be a little bit exhausted after a few hours, so I might forget this again. So
Yep, sure.
yeah, so thank you. So let's just move on. Now it is recording, and that's not so big deal. And let's continue on with the second exercise. So it's about the analysis of gap and parameters. So if you look at the question sheet, we have equations 2.1 and 2.2. Let's read them this through so that we understand what's happening in the equation. So, on the left-hand side, we have an excess return of some security, and on the right-hand side, we have excess return on a proxy on the market portfolio, and then we have the beta parameter. So, the most important thing here is the beta parameter. What it says in the CAPM is that the individual variances of the stocks are not important, but their covariance with the market portfolio. So that was basically the huge innovation of the CAPM model. Back in the day, Sharpe-Lindrow version was 1964, if I remember that correctly. So not individual stocks, but their co-movement with the market portfolio. That's important. And the beta parameter here measures the risk. Meaning intuitively that there's a linear relationship between the risk and return, meaning that in the idealized world, the more you take risk, the higher returns you can wait. But of course, there's a downside then also on the other hand. So the exercise gives us the value of the gives us the estimate of the beta and then the standard errors. And then in the first part, there's an analyst that has told us that there's a security that follows the market closely, but on average, it bears no more risk. And then we should test this by we should test it, and we have enough observations. So here we have a one, so the exercise asks us to do one-sided test. This means that we ignore the other side of the We ignore the other side of the we ignore the other side of the test and only concentrate on the other tail of the distribution. So basically this means that we have some reasons just to ignore the other side. We could just think about that. We could just think about assume that the analyst is maybe telling us the truth. or we are not interested in the other side of the distribution. So we are asked to write the null and alternative hypothesis. So a standard t-test has three different parts. In the first part, we are writing the hypothesis. Here it means that we are testing that beta is one. That's something that is asked, and then our alternative is that is higher than one. If we have a two-sided test, it would be unequal. And then in the second part, we calculate the t-stat, and that is done simply by taking our estimate here and subtracting the test value from it, and then dividing this result by the standard error. So this is what we get. We subtract one from our estimate and divide it by the given standard error, and this is the value we get. And then in the third part, we compare our test statistic with the distributional value. And with the one-sided test is 1.67. And as this value, and then we have to take into account the degrees of freedom, and that are our observations minus two. So basically what this means, that as our value is higher than the t-stat, we conclude that the null hypothesis doesn't stay in the power, and we can reject it. And this means that when we're rejecting the null, the security is riskier than the market. From this, we can conclude that analyst is probably some bankster who's trying to sell some stuff, and he might be even lying.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yep.
So where did you come up with that 1.671? Comparing it to what? T-table?
That's student t-stat given it's t-table. It's taken from the t-table. So
Where can I find it?
T-table. Probably you don't. If you want to find it, you can just, for the sake of simplicity, just Google it, t-table, and then if you Google t-table and then look at the given pictures, you should find a picture that has p-values as columns and degrees of freedoms as rows. And given here that we have 60 degrees of freedom, it's that means that we have already over 30 degrees of freedom. So basically then we use the value zeta, or the value below the 30. And then when we think about the right column, it is just something we choose. So if we choose here, as we have a one-sided test, we choose the value 0.1, and then we look at the value what is given here. Excuse me, null 0.05 in this case. And then we look at the value below. But I think the more easier way is just to use a computer program to calculate this. So basically you don't have to look at the detail every time, because it is programmed in the computer software. Did this answer satisfy you or?
Yeah, all right, thanks.
So the second part, no, in the second part, the analyst, now it's about the Nokia shares and about and the analyst is telling us that they share no systemic risk. So this means, in other words, that the returns on the share are completely unrelated to the movements of the movements in the market. And this is the and the second part of the sentence. It's that it's the basic idea of the CAPM. Basic idea of the CAPM. There's something. Sorry, there's something happening in the chat. So, okay, it's Alexandra sharing. Thank you.
I just found the tea tables, and here is the link. And if you go to this link, you go to the table A3, and then on the vertical axis, you can see the degrees of freedom, and you look at the 60, and then on the horizontal, there is 5% significance level, and on the intersect, you can find this value of 1.671. That's all I wanted to
show. Thanks. I'll try to follow the chat more closely that I can see immediately when something is written there. But yeah, let's continue with the second part of the exercise. So it's about the Nokia shares and no systemic risk, and then there's the basic idea of the CAPM that the movements of the movements or the changes in the shares are should be think in relationship with the market portfolio. And then we are giving the value of the beta and the standard error. And then we are asked to write the null and the alternative and do the two-sided testing. And then in the second part is about confidence intervals. But let's do the first part. So basically, so now we're asking whether the value of the parameter is different from zero. And so the test is not restricted like in the A part. So again, there are three parts, and this is something you should learn by heart of doing a statistical inference. And in this case, this is the t-test. In the first part, it is about presenting the hypothesis. In the second part, it is about calculating the t-stat. And in the third part, it is about the comparing the t-stat with the distribution. Those are the three different stages of doing a statistical inference. So this is our hypothesis, and then we are calculating the t-stat. So we take the estimate and subtract zero from it and divide this by the standard error of the estimate. And in order to compare it with the distribution, we need degrees of freedom. And from this, given the table that Alexandra gave us earlier, it tells us that the critical value is 2.00, And when we compare this value with our t-stat, we see that our t-stat is lower than the critical value. And hence, we do not reject our null and it stays in power. And this means that it is truly the case, or our inference strengthens the saying of the analyst, that it seems to be really the case that the Nokia shares bear no systemic risk. And then in the second part of this, we are asked about confidence intervals for the beta. So why are confidence intervals important? So our sample has given us a sample mean, that means an average mean. But the average means is not the same as the population mean. So population means like a true value of the underlying parameter. So usually there's something more involved with samples than, so we cannot think is that it equals its true value. So by using confidence intervals, we can have an idea where the true value of this parameter really is. And this means we take our estimate, and then we add and subtract and value of standard error times our t-stat to get an interval. And this interval is the confidence interval, meaning that when we are using the 95% limits, this means that we can be 95% confident that the true value of the parameter is within these values. And these values are minus 0.164 and 0.592. So the true value is somewhere within this interval. And if we used an 99%, if we want to be 99% confident about the true value, we just change our t-stat. And the interval would change into these values. So basically this just means that our sample comes always with the error. There's a margin of error, and we want to also think about this margin so that we have a better idea where the true value of the parameter can be. So this was the second exercise, and then we are going. Then we are doing some intro to R and Stata, and.
You have, before we go to the intro, there is a question in the chat. Are these answers somewhere in Moodle? I think you have not uploaded them yet. Are you planning to?
We haven't uploaded. Yeah, we haven't uploaded the suggested solutions. Oh, okay. So, so then this is my bad. So, I can't remember. Did we agree with the Juha that should we upload this? But yeah, I for sure I asked earlier to check this. So then it's or did I? Well, it doesn't matter. But yeah, this will be uploaded for sure later on. So after the session, I will upload the suggested solutions. Of course, of course I didn't upload it because they're suggested solutions. So naturally they're given after the session. So yeah. But yeah, I will upload these solutions afterwards. Yeah, then the third part. So we assume that you've already installed both of these programs, R and Stata. And I'm going to introduce you through these softwares when we are running through the exercise. But before we go into these computer exercises, we could have we could look a little bit about how you're able to download data from DataStream. So I'll share you another screen. So DataStream is one of the best places to find data. And unfortunately, I cannot give you the password to this program, but I believe Juha will give you. But this can be so really quickly. Now I'll just sign out and show you how the steps are done. How you can use DataStream. So first of all, is it the Africa computer room? I believe it's Africa where you can use DataStream.
Yep.
So. It's so. First of all, you have to find the Excel spread for DataStream, and then go Refinitiv Aicon tab, and then you'll have to find a place where you can sign in. So first of all, you'll just first of all, you sign in. And then we'll have to wait. Apparently something that the computer is doing signing. So now it is in use. Then go to Refinitiv Aicon DataStream tab, and most important place here, the time series request. This is the place you'll find the data. So let's just click over there. And we'll have a following screen. Please tell me if you can't see it. Here's another tab. Alexandra, can you see this?
Yep, I can see.
Everything is following. So this is the tab where we are doing our requests. So let's go find some data. So it's simply find series and click over there. And we'll get the following screen. So in today's news, there was something it was about the GDP of the China has increased last year. That is truly, truly peculiar this in this stage of the world. So Let's look some China's data. Let's look at the foreign of China's offshore foreign exchange rate. How it's behaving as of lately. So what I did, I wrote there something, whatever you want to find in the here up above, and then it'll print all kind of series. And from here we can see that these series are mostly about China's offshore exchange rate related to the forward USD exchange rate. But here we have a China yuan to US. So this is the spot rate. The previous one were forward rates. And from this series, we can see how China's offshore exchange has been performing as of lately. And here, there are different alternatives. This means EB is a bid price and EO is an offered price. But let's use here a middle price that is, I believe, technically just the average of the bid and offered price. So let's take that one. Let's use this series, and we can find more different alternatives for the series here. Let's just select this and use this series. And now we are back in our starting point. The series has been chosen. This is the name of the series, and this is the middle rates that goes by this acronym ER. And then we can start specifying our starting date. Because I'm lazy, I'll just choose the base date and we'll get all the possible data. And then we can choose our frequency. And here are the different alternatives but let's use now daily series. And then we have end series, and we can skip that. Let's just, because by default it'll choose the most latest value. And then there are other options, but let's skip them. Let's skip this for start. So find series, and then we'll have to submit this. From here we can see our series, and we can do the basic things with the Excels. Let's use this series, and then we can do a chart here. This is our chart. This is China's offshore exchange rate, and this is actually a different rate that China is using inland. So China has still today pretty hard capital controls. So this rate differs from the inland exchange rate. But from here, we can, just looking at the series, we can hear that from 2011 till August 2015, the series has progressed quite steadily. There's some turbulences, some more drastic movements somewhere, but it mostly appreciated till the beginning 2014, and then it has a little bit decreased, and then there's a sudden jump in August 2015, and the series start to act more volatile, and this is actually the breaking point of the pricing of the China's central bank's central rate. I can't remember what was its precise name, but the rate that the China's people banks of China's central, in other words, China's central bank is controlling. There was a new calculation method was implemented over here. So afterwards, the series has has become more volatile, and now it has and look more lately somehow. But from here we can, as of lately, we can see that China's renminbi has appreciated against the dollar from somehow, I don't know why doesn't it show the date, but it has strengthened, appreciated like half a year now. And now today we got some data that China is performing, or the official data of the China says that China is performing really, really well. Of course, there are other issues about the credibility of the Chinese data, but in every case, how all it gives us some hints about how their economy is performing, and it can be good. And there can be some, we can apply here the confidence intervals that there's some interval that this performance is credible, that we can be confident within some interval that this is the true performing measure. And the other thing with the data stream, I want to show you. Let's go back there and again, time series request, and then find series. And we are back here again. Other way you can use data stream to explore data is just to see this bottom here, explore top left. Just click it and you'll get the following categories. Here you can start restricting your searches how you want. So let's look at the, for example, equity indices. Click over there. Let's check by sector. Let's look at, for example, Euro stocks and financial indices. And then how banks have been performing as of lately. And here we get a bunch of different series. So let's check that one. So this is how European banks have been performing as of lately. Until the 2008, their values has been increasing and increasing, but since then only decreasing. But yeah, for sure, this is the way you can find all kind of stuff from data stream. Ask Juha for the password using this. So I think we are through with the data stream, and let's continue with the fourth exercise.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So can we use this data stream in our home computers, or is it only available in Africa?
Only in Africa, unfortunately.
Okay.
So next, let's open R. So I'll just pause a little bit here that you have, if you haven't already opened your software, you still have time to do it. So basically, as this is the first demonstration sessions, we will be looking more carefully about the individual operations of the R, so that you get a better grasp how this software works. It seems that The question that Kimmo just asked comes actually a little bit lagged in this chat. This is a little bit strange, but now, or at least it informed me a little bit later that it came. It had just arrived. So please, just whenever you have something to ask, just turn the mic on. I believe that's the quickest way that I'm not explaining something like something else next 10 minutes and then going back into something else. But yeah, I suppose you're already opened your R. So first of all, please click the session tab. And then we'll look at the set working directory. So I assume that you have already know where your data is. So then you just click choose directory and choose the folder where your data is. So that you have, alternatively, you can set the working directory by command just by typing here this command and typing the command in the XXX folder. And then we have to, I suppose you're already installed the missing packages I asked earlier. If you haven't, you can do it easily by using the highlighted command, install the packages, and then the name of the packages over there. But if you have already installed it, just type library and the name of the packages. And then we'll need these two packages. So after the packages are loaded, let's go into this fourth exercise, and we could do some parts of this, not all, because the fifth and sixth exercises are a little bit shorter. So let's begin and then look how far we get before the break. So the fourth exercise, it's about the optimal hedging ratio. So we are analyzing a situation where the investor wishes to hedge a long position in SPX by using a short position in the futures contract. And our optimal hedge here is the slope coefficient. So let's do the first step and import the data. Personally, I like to use only the keyboard, and because it is quicker, so you can highlight really easily the text just by pressing shift and pressing and arrow downwards. Just write, try this and press shift and clicking the arrows. So highlight the text and then press control and enter. So I'll write that here. And it executes the command. So now we've uploaded the data. We see our data here in data. It contains over 200 observations and 4 variables. Then, because sometimes we could need the number of our how many rows there are in data, we can restore it, and this is done basically. N here is the name of the variable I want that has stored these values. So number of rows, and then within the square, within the round brackets, I've put this variable from, I want this number to be found. Again, highlight and control plus enter, and you'll get the values. So basically the basic function of the R is that you have a command and square, round brackets, and then you can specify what the computer does, software does. And now we have our data, and in the second part, we are asked to transfer our levels of the series into continuously compounded returns, and this means luck returns. So this is the name of the variable I want my spot returns to be found in. And what I'm doing in this line, there are multiple brackets. Let's first look at the, let's start by here. I've highlighted the df, that's our data variable. If we want to look at it, we can just type view fdf and we'll see what's over there. We'll see that we have dates, spot values, future values, and some fourth variable that is just nothing. That's somehow just over there. I don't know why. Some kind of error, that's the variable is over there. It's not important. But from here, we can see our data table. And then df is the name of the data. And then there's this dollar sign. The dollar sign can be used to specify the column in the data. So spot specifies our column. df, the data, dollar sign, what is specified in the data, and spot, the column in question we want to specify. And then we have square brackets. And square brackets specify here that our observations we want here first began from the second observations until continue till the end of the series. From the second every observation from the second to the last one. And then we're asked to take or make log transformation of this series. So we'll take the log of this and then we'll subtract the one. This is the t value of the series, and this second one is t minus one value of the series. The same thing, square brackets, the number of the observations in question, one observation before the observation, the first part, the same column, the same data, and the log form. So we'll take the log series of the t minus one value, and then we multiply this difference by 100. And we multiply by 100 because we want to deal with the percentages. So we'll run the series. And we'll do the same thing for the future series. We have log values, and their difference is the return of the series. The difference of the log is return, and then we multiply this return by 100, so we're dealing with the percentages. So we're doing the similar with the futures. Highlighting, just to repeat this again, press shift and use arrows, or you can just double click it by cursor and it gets highlighted, and run, then use this run option over there to do the same thing. Either control enter or run. So now we are taking the, now we have returns over the whole series, and then we're setting up two subsamples, and we are asked to set this subsample from the February 2002 to August 2008, and the second sample from there onwards. So first of all, In order to specify subsamples, we need date. So this is our date variable. And then in the second part, we start to use our subsample subset function. So to understand how this function works, we can look at the help manual of the R. And the help manual can always be used by typing question mark and then writing the name of the set. And then R specifies different alternatives from which you can choose. But here we want to only have a subset. The help manual is printed over here. In this case, I believe that the help manuals are pretty similar, but let's just look at the data tables. And from here, we can you see how the functions are used. Here the arguments are explained, and then details are given. And then in the end, there are some examples. So here, subset, the first argument is the X over here. So that's the data table in question. And our data table we want to use is this spot returns. Then in the second argument, we are asked to set the subset. And this is our previously specified variable. And then this argument functions as a logical expressions. So we use our data variable, and then we define the logical operation we want to use. So here we want every observation before the September. So we'll use that as a date. And in this case, we only need these two arguments. These two arguments are doing everything we want. The series in question, and then the specified subsample. So let's run the command. And now we have our first spot series, and let's do the same for the future subsample. And similarly, for the second subsample from September 2008 onwards, we'll just give the series another name, specify, use them as a subsample two, the series in question and the logical operation. And now every operation, every time observation from beginning of September. So now we've done the second part. We've transformed the series into log returns and then set up two subsamples. The third part, and this is about the descriptive statistics for the whole sample and both subsamples. So let's look at them again. If you some summary gives us some summary information about the variables in question, by typing question mark and summary, we'll again see our help manual that specifies how this command can be used. And here's actually nothing else than summary and the name of the series in question. And it'll print the following. It'll print the following statistics. So let's start interpreting this series. So this is the summary statistic for the whole sample. First, we see that our mean is 0.5, meaning that on average, our spot series on average, SPX is performing or earning 0.5% every month. So, and then we have our median. So how do median and mean differ from each value? If we have, for example, 100 observations and we place them or set them in line, the median is the number 50 from this series, whereas mean is the weighted value of the whole series. From here, we can see that our median return is 0.5% or 0.6% higher than our mean return. This means that our stock number 50 is performing better than the average of the whole series. So this begs a question, what's happening over there? So then we look our minimum value and our maximum value. So our minimum value is that in the most extreme case, our S&P 500 is performing really bad in 1 month, losing almost 20% of its value. Whereas on a most extreme good month, it's like 12% return. So this means that the most extreme effects are so severe that they're pressing the median value downwards. And then In addition, we have the first quantile and third quantile, so meaning 25% of the distributional value of the 25% and a distributional value of the 75%. From this, by adding and subtracting the difference here, it's 2.5 difference with the mean and the 75% and around 2% with the mean and the 25%, meaning that this means that this refers that this distribution is not symmetrically, is not symmetric, so implying that this 25 value is relatively higher than the 75 percentage point value is relatively higher than the 25 point value. So at the same time, this means that there's something that is also increasing the median value of the of this series, that there's something that is also pulling this series higher. So there are two different forces pulling this series into both directions. The most extreme values seems to be most severe on the lower part, whereas there's something pulling also the median value higher from the mean value. So next, let's look at about the volatility of the series. So this is a standard deviation of the series, and the standard deviation tells us how far the individual values of the series are, how far these individual values are from the mean values on average. And we'll see from here that 2.4% value means that this series is quite volatile. That it's going up and down all the time. This number applies both to the upsides and downsides, as the standard deviation is the square root of variance. So, and variance is always positive. So this series is really going in both directions from 1 month to 1 month. So to understand what's happening in more detail, let's look at the first subsample of the series. And this is before September 2008. By comparing these values, we'll see that the mean value is a little bit lower than before, and the median value is also a little bit lower. Whereas the first quantile is almost the same, but the third quantile is lower than before. At the same time, the minimum, the extreme values are not so extreme as in the first case. And also the maximum values are not so high as before. So this says that after the September of 2008, something has happened, that the behavior of this series has changed. Then we'll look at the standard deviation of the series, and we'll see that the volatility is also lower before September 2008, meaning that after the September 2008, the volatility of the series has increased. This means that at the same time, the returns have increased. People are making more money, but at the same time, they are taking more risk to make money. So So then let's look at what are the numbers after the September 2008. And we'll see immediately when we compare, well, I think it's nicer this way. This series below is the whole series, and this series above is the highlighted series is the series after September 2008. We see immediately that the most extreme values in the whole sample are coming after the September 2008. But let's interpret the second subsample. Then if we look at the second subsample, our mean is getting higher than in the whole value. And at the same time, our median returns are getting higher. And at the same time, our 25% quantile is also lower than in the whole sample. This means that as this 25% quantile has increased, this means that returns are overall getting better, but at the same time, the extreme values have increased. And let's then look at the standard deviation of the spot series. And yeah, it's let's compare that with the whole sample, and we'll see that the spot series and the volatility has increased. And if we actually compare this with the one before September 2008, we'll see that there's a 1% increase in the volatility. So that's basically like 20% increase overall. So thinking about the relative difference between these volatilities, it's like that after the 2000 event, people are taking more, 20% more risk. But it seems they have a pretty good reason, as they're making also more money. Although in the extreme case, also losing more money. So that was for the SP 500, and let's look at the future similar statistic for the future series at the same time. So this is for the whole sample, and let's compare that with the spot returns. The highlighted here is the future values, and below is for the comparison. We'll see that the future values are pretty similar overall. So future values and the spot values are seem to be virtually the same. And the volatility is a little bit lower in the and the volatility is actually a little bit higher in the future series. Yes. And then let's look at the first subsample. The future series are below. And the values seem to be the mean values, at least, and the mean values are pretty aligned. Actually, there's a little bit difference with the subsamples. So there's some difference with the futures values and the spot values in the first subsample. The values are more dispersed. So we'll from here, it's we cannot conclude what the reason might be why there's more dispersion between the values. But this is in the first subsample, meaning before September 2008. And then let's look at the second series. And in the second series, the future and both mean and median are almost the same. But overall, the future values seem to be more prone to extreme cases than the spot cases, spot returns. So what we learned just by doing descriptive statistics, there seems to be some kind of structural change before and after the September 2008. And the September 2008 was the peak of the global financial crisis. That was the month that the famous investment bank Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and caused a huge, huge financial market collapsed overall. So, but how does it affect here in our exercise? That success that the hedge ratio between these two periods, and we're after the optimal hedge ratio that can differ by these two periods. So I believe let's, before we have a little break, let's do the fourth part of this exercise and estimate the OLS regressions, and then have a little break. So let's start the fourth part. So again, if we want to understand in details what's happening in the linear, how should this estimation be done? We can check the help manual. And from here, we can see how the linear model is specified. Formula, that's our regression formula. This means that spot returns are the ones we want to estimate. And then after this sign, we're specifying our independent variables we want to use to determine spot returns. So basically, if we think this as an equation, this is the U and this is the X. Dependent variable, independent variable. And this is the data we want to use in our linear model. Comes from this DF matrix. So let's run our first regression. Stata AIR-R differs from other softwares that it doesn't print automatically the print, and we have to use the summary to look what are the results of the regression. So from here, this is our coefficient in question we are interested at. First of all, we see that the sign of our coefficient is positive, meaning that when there's, let's write that in this way. This is our estimated model. So when there's a 1% increase in the futures, it affects the beta parameter, tells us what's the effect to U variable. So around null point one effect means that when there's 1% increase in the X variable here in the futures, this is associated with 0.1% increase with the spot values. So basically, in our setup, what this means, that if we multiply this result by 100, this means that when we want to optimally hedge the movements in spot volumes, the optimal hedge is not 100, optimal hedge by futures is not 100%, rather it's 10%. And then in the next part, let's save the residuals. We weren't asked anything to do, but then just to save them. Okay, then let's do the same thing for our first subsample. Run the similar regression. Actually, I forgot something. Let's return a little bit. We could dwell on this first model a little bit longer, and let's check what would happen if we remove the intercept in the model. So how can we specify intercept in our model? We can here let R find how this is done, and this is done just by typing -1 in our regression models, so it'll remove the intercept. So let's remove the intercept and see, does it affect anything? How does it affect the results? So basically, as you remember from earlier, that basically the effect is the same as earlier. The sign is positive, and 0.1, when there's a 1% increase in the futures, the optimal hedge is 0.1 increase. But let's check the other one. From here, we can see, second thing we want to also take the note on is to look whether our coefficient is statistically significant. So let's look at the first case. This is our regression. And here we have the t-value, our test statistic. And how this test statistic is again calculated, and this is something you should learn to do immediately. Whenever you have a coefficient and then you have standard errors, divide this coefficient by the standard error and you get the t-stat. And if the value is above 1.96, you'll know immediately that it is statistically significant. So here we have only around 1.6. And its p-value is over 0.1. So meaning that our optimal hedge ratio is not statistically significant. Let's look at the same result without the intercept. Does the intercept change anything? Remember, not significant t value. And after we removed the intercept, and our intercept was not also significant at the 5% limit, after we remove our intercept, we see that there's some, our p-value is getting better. We get a higher t-value, but still this would only suggest a minor or weak statistical significance. That means below 10%, but above 5%. And usually we like to think the 5% as a critical limit that the effect has some statistical power. So let's then go to the first subsample. Run the model. Here is the model with intercept. And from here, we can see before the September 2008 that the optimal hedge is 0.20%, but the hedge is only weakly statistically significant, meaning although below 10%, still above the critical 5% limit. Let's check the results without the intercept. And the results are actually virtually the same. Let's try if we can see. Yes, we can see them. The coefficients are almost the same, and the p values are almost the same. There's a small increase, but not large. Somehow, I don't know what happened here. Somehow, I lost my console. Now it's getting back. It was that simple way to get that back. Okay, let's then save the second residuals. And then run our third model. And save the residuals immediately. So our third model, after the peak of the financial crisis, we'll see that optimal hedge ratio has decreased from earlier. Before the crisis, it was 0.2, although not statistically significant. Now it's even lower, and the p-value is getting even further away from the critical limit. And without the intercept, this is, that was the wrong model, looks so strange. And the same thing without the intercept, and the results are the coefficients, let's print that again, the earlier result. Here we have around 0.07, and here we have around 0.08. to 0.09. The coefficient gets a little bit better, but it is still far from away from statistical significance. So I think we can have now a little break.
So I ask two questions.
Yeah. Sure.
So when we use the function to regress linear regression, why do we need the define the data as df? Doesn't the two first variables contain every information we need for the regressing?
So you're asking that is our model capturing all the information necessary?
No, it's more technical question. For example, in the line 17.
Okay.
70. We have in this function, when we call this function, we have defined that data is df.
Yes.
Do we need that? Because why doesn't the two first variables, spot CCR and future CCR, contain every information we need to do the linear regression?
So let's just check that one. Let's write the linear regression without the last argument and see what happens. And that's the same result. So
okay.
But yeah, in this case, we have just specified our data. Usually that's the case. Right now I'm thinking if I have two different data sets, would this have any effect? But I suppose not. I'm doing that just by convention, so I can't remember all the details.
So I have another question. Yes. So in the line 21. When we define the spot CCR.
Yes.
Does the spot CCR now contain any information about the other columns, like the date, or is it just a list of numbers?
Yes, the second case, it's just a log return of the series. So by hand, if we did this like this, let's just use one observation and do this like this. And take the, so we have t value and t minus one value, and let's multiply the difference by 100. We get this value, and if we look here from the look at my cursor. Here we'll see that's the same value that I'm pointing my cursor at. So it's the series of individual values, and without specifying this series as a time series, that's the time series part we are doing in another exercise. But here we are not, that isn't necessary. We can do just or without specifying the date of this series. But yeah, usually it's the good case when we are dealing with the time series also to specify the time values of these numbers. So if there are no other questions, we could have a 20 minutes break, and let's continue 15 minutes past.
I have an issue if you could check something out.
Yes.
My R will not read the data correctly, so it gives me an error all the time.
Okay.
First of all, it had problem finding the data, but I brought it manually, but still having issues with it.
Yes, so you're having problems right from...
right from the start, but I have used like R before, so I know what you've been doing and I've been following. So all I have to do basically is print out the commands, and that's all I need to do. But I literally have problem with the data, so I need help with that. Can I share the screen for a bit so I can show you what is happening? It's giving me the error message that there's...
Hopefully you're able to share your screen. Have you done this before? Yes.
Yes, I have used like R before, and I've done the R course. So what I've done is just brought that... write Excel spreadsheet out from my computer, but it does not follow the or it does not want to store the amount of rows that I have, and it doesn't even want to do any of the commands you have given us.
Okay, I can see the error. First of all, when importing, you should change the name from SNPHXLS to DF.
So you want me to change the whole?
No, not here. Like in the console, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 line from the top in console. Yep.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yep.
Here, instead of SNPHXLS, you should write DF. This is the name of the data set where you...
Yeah. Okay, so if I do that and then this. So this is a problem that it literally did not download the data correctly. So I had to bring it manually. So this is probably part of that. So, let's see. And then if we erase this, it cannot be. Yeah, so I had defined the data with the wrong name, so it could not read it. That was the problem. So let's try now. Yeah, now it's working.
Yep.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Good to get you going.
Can you hold this here for a second so I can take a picture of it?
Mine or...
Yeah, yours.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks.
Did you get it?
Yeah, I got it.
Nah.
Thanks.
No problem.
So I have some things to do, so let's have a 20-minute break and let's continue around 20 past. So we're back. Let's continue after a few minutes.
I was thinking that before you go fifth question in R, maybe I should go briefly through the fourth question and state that you think.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yep, just to like highlight some differences. Let me share the screen. Yep, can you see my screen now?
Yes. So you want to show this, to show the differences between the software?
Yeah. Okay, I think we can start now.
Yeah, let's continue.
So, as that, yeah, there are different softwares that you can use to do the time series analysis, and one of the is this Stata software. So this year we also introduced the codes in Stata for the demo sessions. And it's relatives advantage and disadvantages to R. And here, I think just like discuss briefly codes and find in the Moodle. The first thing I wanted to point out is that Stata is kind of very choosy in the date form. So it means that you should be really careful. If what time variable here, I figured out how to set the time variable, this one of the variants, here, like from in the test, so just like in R, you hide the and then you press here, execute, and then you have the output window. If you can put window. Okay, maybe not. So basically here, first of all, you have to the data as string variables. Then fifth, in order to use the spot variable, you have to string them. But why we import the data all string is because we want the Stata know that our day time variable is a monthly variable, and it can process only the string variable. So here then we're generating a date monthly variable, formatting it a little bit, dropping the actual date to prepare the data set for time series analysis. We use this command tset and date. And this means that now we're able to use all the time series functions for the analysis. Here, lines 13, 14, we are generating the continuously compounded returns for the spread and pairs. Just like in R, the syntax is a bit different, but just that here in brackets, we should use the underscore first, and then the N, and then if we want to take the changes, then we do the minus, and then logarithm of spot variable previous observation N minus one. Then also another difference with R. In R, to use the subsample, there is this subset function. But here you can get the subsample by using the if condition. So here we are generating new variable, sport returns subsample one, which is equal to our initial sport returns variable, and we are imposing this if condition. If date is less than September 2008, and TM is a monthly format that you have to use so that you get the necessary subsample. The same thing we do for the subsample too. Then getting the descriptive statistics, we're using the command summarize. If you are just using the summarize command, then you will get just the mean, standard deviation, minimum and maximum. But if you will specify comma detail, then you will get some additional descriptive statistics, like, let's say, like variation and also skewness coefficient. So here we'll also do it for the subsample one and subsample two. Then we're performing the linear regression here. So to do the OLS regression, we just use the regress command. And then the first we specify the independent variable, sport returns, followed by the dependent variable, sport returns, and then followed by the independent variables, futures returns. And we do it also for the subsample one, subsample two. The results are exactly the same as in R. Then in order to save the residuals from the regression models, in stata here, we did not save the regression outputs. This means that if we will just run this command predict residuals right after this line, it will give us the residuals for the subsample two regression. So if you want to get the residuals for the regression of the whole sample, we again have to write the command regress support returns on futures returns, and then predict. We specify the name of the residuals variable. Here is resid support CCR. And then after the comma, you're writing residuals. So yeah, and the same thing for subsample one and subsample two. And another thing which differs Stata from R is that here there is no function that can store the variation of the variable, but you can always get the variation of the variable from the summary statistics, just like by running summarize spot returns detail, and then to calculate the optimal hedge ratio, you need to get the variation of the residuals also. So you again write summarize the residuals, comma detail, and then you can use Stata also just like a calculator. So you just copy the variation of spot returns. Here is 18.67382. And then this one is the variation of residuals. And again, we divide it by the variation of the spot returns, multiplied by 100. And you use the common display to show the result.
I'm afraid, Alexandra, I have to stop you now. Now you're getting into a fifth part and we are going that to next. So you're moving just a minor step ahead. So
okay, yeah. Then maybe I should stop sharing now. Yep.
But thank you. Yep. So let me share my screen. And of course, start the video. So again, just turn the mic on if something is wrong. So we'll continue. So earlier we were doing the fourth part, but that was the linear regressions of the model, and we calculated the optimal hedge ratio, but according to our results, that didn't seem to be statistically significant. So next, let's continue on the next part. That is the fifth part. And we're asked to compare the variances of spot returns with the residuals from the OLS regressions to estimating optimal hedge ratio. And we are doing this to analyze the effectiveness of the hedge for the whole, to see how the effectiveness of the hedge for the whole sample and for the two sample sets differ. So first, by using var command, that is variance, we'll get the spot variances. And then this is our residuals variances. The numbers Alexandra was showing earlier were these two numbers, and we were calculating the relative change of these values, and we do so to calculate the fall or the decrease in variance from using the hedge portfolio. So let's do that. That is just the relative difference. And let's print our values. From here, you see comparing this number to the one above, you see that they are the same, and the other number is the same as this. And the last one is the relative change. And this means that percentage-wise, there's only 1% difference between the variances of the spot return variance and the hedge portfolio variance. So the 1% means that that's not pretty much. And that was for the whole sample. And let's do that, the same thing for our fourth subsample. So let's take the spot variances and the residuals variances. And then let's look at the same figures. Before September 2008, we'll see that the variances are lower than in a whole sample that includes also the period afterwards. But when we calculate the relative difference between these variances, it's only shy from 4%, so not so much again. But at least a little bit more significant than, economically a little bit more significant than earlier. And then after the peak of the financial crisis, we'll see immediately that we're getting a little bit higher variances. But let's calculate the relative difference. It's like 0.6%. So basically, that's about nothing. But what is important here, that we'll see that before and after the global peak of the financial crisis, we see the change in the volatility. The markets have become more volatile afterwards. So probably as the sample period after the peak of the financial crisis includes more turbulent periods, there's some volatility clustering going on. And the volatility clustering means that when there's a, think this intuitively, think this like this way, that there's a company that reports huge annual losses, and this news comes as a surprise. So probably the stock value would go even like minus 30% the same day. And then probably the turbulence is also continue on the day after, and maybe even day after, before it starts to correct again the price, meaning that we have arrived at the low and it starts to go again in another direction. So volatility clustering means that when there's a huge change happens, it is probable that there's another huge change happening afterwards. But this, our results, the difference between the periods suggests that we should start thinking about modeling the risk and returns differently for these periods, that there's a really structural change has happened in the global financial crisis and things have changed. Actually, this could be extended again to last year when we have the COVID-19 turmoil that was in March last year. Then again, we saw mid-March, we saw like minus 10% days going one after another. So there was again this volatility clustering going on, the huge changes happening again after huge changes. And one of the possibilities of modeling volatility clustering is use CARDS type of models. And then the next part, the sixth part. Now we are asked to look at the levels data. So this is we're a little bit alternating our perspective. So previously we were looking at returns. That means the differences between the time periods. And now we're only looking at the time periods themselves. So we're not anymore talking about the hedge ratios, but only increases from one time period to another. So basically we're asked to run the similar regressions as earlier, but with on a different data sets. So let's get going on, and this is in the highlighted equation we are doing a linear regression for the spot values, spot levels, and using as future levels as a regressor. And again, just to repeat the structure of R again, if you can't remember what's some command, just type the question mark and then the name of the function and you'll get the help menu. So let's run the regression, and by using the summary statistics, we'll get the results. So again, now our intercept is really, really minus 7%, but it is not statistically significant. But our coefficient of the futures is now it is high. This means that when there's a 1% increase. Percentage increase in the future values, basically 1% increase also in the spot values. So this means that the levels are correlating really closely together. Differences weren't really not so heavily correlated, but levels seem to be really, really heavily concentrated. Correlating together. And then we have standard error, and when we divide this by the standard error, or to say it other ways, if we use the t-stat and multiply the t-stat by standard error, we are getting this measure. Well, meaning that our t-stat is really high. This is like the statistical significance is really strong, and really strong here means below 1%, and there are a lot of zero decimals before this number means that. So it's really statistically significant. This means that the future levels are associated statistically really strongly significantly with the levels of the spot returns. Spot prices. So let's look how they are behaving by plotting them. And this can be done by using plot command. This first argument here is our x-axis, and the second argument is our u-axis. And third argument just specifies that it is the we're using line and not, for example, dots. So let's make that look a little bit better. So this is the movement of spot levels. And then we're adding the futures. And it seems that the series are virtually the same. They're moving really closely together, although we see from here that future levels are lacking a little bit behind from the spot levels. It is usual, there isn't many cases where the future prices would forecast the spot prices. And after, from 2020, and meaning that after the COVID broke, the lag is even bigger. Or actually it's not, actually it stays the same, but the movements are more drastic. So it looks visually as if it would be, it lagged a little bit more. So that was for the whole series, and next, the same thing for our first subsample. So we're using the previous subset command to calculate our subsample for spot and future series. And after that, we can run our regression. So this means before the peak of the financial crisis, 1% increased in the futures was associated with a little bit 1% increase with the spot values of the SPX, meaning asset B500. But again, dividing the coefficient by standard error, we get the T value. And remember that the critical level is 1.96, or to remember it, or more easy to remember, just to think the value of the two. So this is far from value of the two, meaning that it is, again, highly significant, meaning that there's a strong association between the series. Let's look at the graphs again. And this is the same graph as earlier, but now before the peak of the financial crisis. And we see the same thing as earlier. There's not so much to add here. Then our second subsample. First, let's calculate the subsamples, then run the linear regression. In a linear regression, this is the U value, and everything that comes behind this sign is the X value. So we're only using in this case one independent variable as an explanatory variable, but there could be others. If we put plus something, then there would be more independent variables. And then let's look at the summary statistic. again the same. Levels are economically associated really, really well, and the t-values is highly significant. And then let's look at the series again. We are seeing the similar result as earlier. So overall, we can conclude from this that price levels are connected, even though their returns were not so much connected. And yeah, from the corona period, we see that there are some outliers. Meaning that when the changes are so drastic here, comparing to the changes earlier on, these changes are affecting the return series. Return series meaning return is the difference between the two values. That means the change between the two values. And then we can go into the last part. So it's about testing the null hypothesis and doing this for the whole sample and both subsamples. So basically, we are asked to perform three F tests. And in our first test, we are not restricting our model any further, that we'll test whether the coefficients are zero. Now something seems to be wrong. This is a little bit surprising as I run this earlier and there was no errors. So I'll run the whole code again to see if something bad has happened. So let's try this again. Okay, now it works. This is just one of the oddities with the R. I have no idea where did that come from. But if you happen to have similar kind of problem, just run all, just clear everything by using this command. This clears your environment so that you can start from the beginning again. Okay, so first of all, we ask what is our null hypothesis. So we have a restricted model and unrestricted model, meaning that our null is that there's the difference between the two models is there's no, or our null is that there is no difference between our models. And if we reject the difference, the result is that there is a difference. So let's look at the test. Let's go again through the three different stages of how the statistical inference is made. So in the first stage, we have to know what our hypothesis is. In the second stage, we are calculating our test statistic, that is in this case, F-stat. And in the third phase, we are comparing this test statistic with the probability distribution. And that's the probability, it's C-square distribution in this case, and this is the value in this distribution. So we see our p-value that is a little bit over 0.05, meaning that our critical level is the 5%, and this is a little bit above it. So we could say that our results are a little bit mixed. There seems to be some statistical significance, but it doesn't exceed the critical level. And then we'll do the similar test by testing whether our beta coefficient is 1. Now we get a really strongly significant results. So our null hypothesis is that there is no difference between the models, and we get a really high test value that implies in a C-square distribution really, really low p-value. It's really, really, really strongly statistically significant, meaning that our inference is that there is a difference between the models. And then we'll do the standard F test in the third case. And from the p-value, we see that our statistical significance is really strong. And to repeat this until the boredom, I'll say the three different stages again. In the first stages, what are the hypotheses? In the second test stages, calculate the test statistic. And in the third stage, compare the test statistic with the probability distribution. And you don't have to, computer always does this, but when you're doing research, you just have to know these stages.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
So when you are saying that there is or isn't a difference between the models, what are the models? Is the other one that, what are the models? The two models? Or what is the restricted model in this case?
So our restricted model is this. So let's look at the help of this test. Well, for short, the restrict this is our restriction. So our Well, testing that whether our coefficients are equal to zero.
Okay, yes.
Sorry, right now I can't come up with a better example, so intuitively better example, so but in the next case we are this restriction comes from the CAPM model, like the was it first like in the second exercise that we used the value of one to do the one-sided t-test. So this restrictions comes actually from the financial theory, and we are testing the significance of the financial theory. Does it apply to the data? Or Alexandra, do you have anything? Can you put this in a better way?
Well, I'm actually also thinking about the restricted model. I have not come up with the answer yet. Like, yeah, just like we, in the model one, like we set, the restricted means that we set the intercept and the coefficient on future regions to zero.
Yes, that's the standard F.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's get going on. So we'll do the same thing for the first subsample. Specify our model in case and our restrictions. And the first subsample says that it says there's no difference between the restricted model and the model where we are explaining spot returns by futures returns. So this means that they are performing in the same way. And then instead of restricting our parameters to zero, let's restrict them by setting them one. And now we see a highly statistically significant result. And in the last case, we are just restricting our only our intercept of the model. And again, we'll see that our result is strongly significant. And meaning that when the result is significant, we are rejecting the null, and this means that there is a difference between the models. And then for the second subsample, we see that our p-value is not significant, meaning that the difference is zero. In the second case, p-value is below 0.05 or even below, or in this case, this is even so really far, far away from the zero that it is really strongly significant, meaning that there is a difference. And in a third case, there is a difference. Okay, in the second subsample, as we look at the series, as we look at the series, we saw that the differences increased after the corona period. So economically, this means that the coronavirus is disturbing the correlations, and due to these disturbances, there's a difference between the models. And from here, we can conclude our fourth exercise. And our conclusion is that levels, meaning prices, seem to be linearly connected or associated with each other, but the returns, meaning the differences of the series, are not so much. And then to understand more in detail what is going on here, as we find that there are strongly, as there is this volatility clustering, meaning that the high disturbances or high changes are followed by high changes, we could start studying these relationships by using a model for volatility clustering, and one possibility is Karch type of modeling. So this was this one exercise took a little bit time. The fifth and sixth one are more quicker, and we should be able to get this through during this session. So now open the R code for the fifth question. And let's continue. Let's first clear our tables so that if there are something disturbing, it wouldn't disturb us. So first we're asked to import data, so let's do that. And secondly, let's calculate the rows. If we're just in the, might need them in some case. Then I'll a little bit speed up this, because this is basically the same as we did earlier. Here we are calculating the returns for each column. So we have log differences, meaning that this is our t value and this is our t minus one value. So we're taking log of each series and calculating their differences and then multiplying the result by 100 so that we get the percentages. We'll do that for each of these four companies in question, or five companies actually in question, and for the aggregate. And then we are calculating our monthly bill returns. Meaning that usually percentages are usually given annually, and we want that our interest rates are in the same have the same time length as our stocks. That's why we're dividing it by 12. And then we're asked to calculate the excess return, meaning...
Excuse me, I have one question. What was the remove tables command you used earlier in the console?
Earlier. I'll type it here that you have it all the time.
Okay, thanks.
Next, we want to calculate our excess returns, meaning we are using 3 months bill rates as a risk-free measure, and we are calculating the excess of the more riskier instrument relative to risk-free instrument. So taking the difference between the series. And then we are asked to set 2 subsamples, and this is done similarly as earlier. So let's just run that one, and we have our subsamples. And next, let's look at the plot, what is happening. So from in the x-axis, we have excess return of S&P 500 and the u-axis, the excess return of the Ford Corporation. This success that there's a positive linear might suggest that there's a positive linear relationship between the variables, meaning that when the value of the S&P excess value of the S&P is increasing, we are also increasing in the value of the Ford stock. So let's look whether that's really the case and draw a line there. And yeah, it seems that there's some really, really weak linear association, meaning that when the S&P is increasing, there's some minor increase also in the Ford stock. Let's block the excess returns of the Ford and the S&Ps. So this is the this is the raw data of the individual series. Yeah. The picture earlier was how this series behave together. This is just how the individual returns are behaving. From here, we can see that, let's put that, try if it looks a little bit better. So, the Ford company is here, the black line, that's and S&P is the red line. We see immediately that the Ford is more volatile than the S&P, the index itself. During the financial crisis, it the value collapsed over 60%. And then few months afterwards, it increased also 60%. So really, really volatile period. And then the but overall, we can see that their movement seems to be correlated, but the movements of the returns of the Ford are more drastic than the major index itself. And if in the fifth part, in the last part of this fifth exercise, we are asked to estimate the regressors, CAPM regressors, meaning here that as an excess value, excess return of the S&P 500 is our market portfolio or proxy for the market portfolio. And this is the individual stock we want to explain. Actually, here you could look at your question sheet. Just go to the beginning of your excess question sheet and look at the equation 2.1. So what we are doing here, this what is within the square brackets, that is our proxy of the S&P 500. And what's on the left-hand side of the equation is the Ford Corporation. So that is our equation, what we are running. So let's look at it. This suggests that the excess returns of the S&P 500, when there's a 1% increase in the percentage increase in the excess return of the S&P 500, it affects around 1.1 till 1.6% till the returns of the Ford corporations. And again, we get our T-stat by dividing our coefficient by the standard error. And this is the t-stat. And the value is highly over the intuitive value of 2, meaning that there's a strong statistical association between the variables. So this was for the whole sample, and next we do the similar thing for our subsample. That means before the peak of the financial crisis. Or let's stop here and go actually a little bit backwards. And run for the whole sample without the intercept. It's also good to do these kind of exercises. For the sake of comparison, let's run the both models. So in the first case, this is with the intercept. The intercept is not statistically significant, as it shouldn't in the CAPM model. If the intercept of the CAPM is statistically significant, that means that there's someone actively manipulating the risk-free rate.
I have a question.
Yes.
From an like economic analysis point of view, what is the reason to remove the intercept?
This is
when comparing these.
This is actually why we are removing the intercept in this case is because of CAPM model, because the CAPM model says that the only significant factor that affects the returns of the stocks are market risk. Meaning that the market risk is the factor driving the returns. Meaning that the more risk you take, the higher returns you can get. But from the economic point of view, this means, and here we are talking about a Sarpe-Lindner CAPM model from the 1964, if I remember the year correctly. This implies that as the market coefficient is driving all the returns, this implies that the intercept should be zero.
Okay.
But now we have excess returns here. So actually that would change a little bit the interpretation of the intercept of the intercept, but in general, statistically significant intercept means that there's excess alpha in returns. Meaning excess risk-free money to be made. And according to the theory, that shouldn't be possible. Of course, the theory is just some kind of representation of the world, but not the reality itself. And we are testing, does this theory have significance? Or does the theory make sense? Yeah, we already run the model without the intercept, and our coefficient value, it looks pretty much the same as earlier. So we from this point of view, this when the estimate stays about the same, it means that there is some robustness in the estimate, meaning that it's more reliable than in the other case it would like be the value would be like two times the value before. So there's some persistence in the value. That's a good thing, and it'll stay also as statistically significant. And in the previous case, the intercept is below, above the critical value of 0.05. So we can also, that gives us also some freedom to assume that it is not so much. It can be thrown away. Yeah, there's still. This is just a minor note, and we shouldn't be stuck by it. But still, when we are talking about the excess return, the interpretation of the intercept is a little bit different than only with the pure returns, meaning that we're estimating the returns of the Ford company by the returns of the S&P 500. Here we are subtracting the risk-free rate from both of these. But yeah, in a most basic textbook case, let's just think this as a, if you remember the, what was the name of this portfolio theory, this efficient frontiers and stuff like that, if you remember the visual of the basic CAPM stuff. So here the excess return is just the intercept. Hopefully that didn't confuse too much. So let's do the same analysis for the first subsample. And here we see the high statistical significance. Let's remove the intercept. Now remember the value of 1.62, the coefficient and the highly statistical significant. And without the intercept, the coefficient is about the same and there's no difference with the statistical significance. And then let's run the same for after the peak of the financial crisis. Again, our results are similar. And then let's recall these values. And there's no much difference. Again, with or without the intercept, the result is the same. So according to this result, the excess returns before and after the financial crisis, during the both of these periods, it seems to be the case that the excess returns of the S&P 500 are strongly linearly associated with the excess return of the Ford company. So that was our fifth question, and then we'll do the A part of the sixth question. And here we are doing F tests. So here we are. The first test, we're only restricting our excess returns of the S&P 500 to one. In the restricted model, the S&P 500 is one, and in the other model, we're only using S&P as an only explanatory variable explaining the excess returns of the Ford company. And our null hypothesis is that there is no difference between the restricted model and the other model. And when we look at the p-value here, we see that we reject its below the critical limit of the 0.05, implying that we reject our null hypothesis, meaning that there is a difference between these models. And in the second case, in addition to SPX, we're also restricting our intercept and comparing them to the GAPAM model. And again, we see that there is a difference between the models. And let's look what's the case with both subsamples. So before the September 2008, restricting only the S&P 500 and comparing it with the GAPAM, we see that although the statistical significance is not as strong as before, we see that it is below the limit of the 0.05, implying that the models are different. And then let's do the both restrictions. And the null hypothesis is rejected even more strongly. And for the second subsample, first of all, second subsample, meaning after the September 2008, restricted model only S&P 500, and then S&P 500 model without the intercept. I guess I have to run this through again so that it'll get updated. So our restricted model and S&P and the GAPAM model with the intercept. According to our results, there is a difference between the models. And then with both restrictions, again, we'll see that there's a difference between the models. So that was the A part of the sixth questions, and let's do the last one now. Again, let's clear our window so that we have hopefully a little bit less problems. And then we import the data, calculate the rows. Then let's calculate the returns asked. As I look this today, I'm a little Alexandra. As I look this today, I was a little bit surprised that this was maybe something we forgot to discuss earlier on. That there seems to be that there are missing values in the difference between spreads. If we look at the series,
this is strange.
There are some missing values, and the values are missing because we're taking a natural logarithm of the negative value, and mathematically it's not possible. So that's the case why we're missing values. But Somehow, Juha didn't also mention about this. So I believe it's not so big issue. So basically what this means that we are losing some observations, but we should only concentrate on this exercise only from the pedagogical point of view and think that this is just a pedagogical exercise. But there are a little bit problems with the robustness of the results.
Surprisingly, in state, I didn't get any error.
Okay.
This is strange.
Yeah, this is again some of the oddities of the R, I suppose. So
most probably is because state replaces the missing values with zero.
Oh, yes. That. And alternatively, we could divide the series, divide the t value by t minus one value, and then take the log. Then there would be a little bit less these missing values. But so meaning here that maybe one of the possibilities that we could do here is to combine these both series, that calculating the returns in this way, and then in the both cases we get these missing values, but we could combine this series, so I suppose there wouldn't be so much missing values. So this problem is only due to technical problem, but we've missed it earlier. But let's think only this as a pedagogical exercise. So it doesn't let us interpret the results and see what we are getting. So then we are asked to run an APT regression. This is basically the CAPM, we're only using a proxy of the market as the only exploratory variable, but here we are using other in the APT models. There are also other factors, and then there are also some other stuff included in the model. So let's check the results. Overall, our results suggest that returns of the S&P are statistically significantly correlated with the returns of the Microsoft, and then the differences between spreads are also statistically significantly correlated with the returns of the Microsoft. But yeah, here this should be checked more in detail, but that's not so important here. But basically what this model says, that there are lots of variables included in our regression that are unnecessary, and they could be thrown away from the model. So let's check. I did actually that again. So basically that's what we are doing in the last part, that this summary statistics suggest that there are a lot of unnecessary stuff in the model. And in the last part, we're looking what happens if we throw them away. This means that we set this unnecessary coefficients as zero, meaning that they're not affecting our estimation. This is the model where lots of variables are set to zero, and this is the model where they are not to set as zero. So when we compare these two models, we get a result that there is no difference between the models. That is the null hypothesis. To repeat everything until boredom, one more repetition of the one more time how statistical inference is made. In the first stage, we set the null hypothesis. In the second stage, we calculate the test statistic. And in the third stage, we compare it with the probability distribution. And with the case of the F-test is C-square distribution. So I believe that's everything today. Do you have any questions? Alexandra, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I just want to add that we could not, unfortunately, go through the stata quotes in details because otherwise it would take double time. But you can always familiarize yourself with the stata quotes in Moodle. They are there. And in case you will have some questions, you can always contact me directly, so that we can figure out what is the issue and how to solve it. So yeah, and as far as I know, you can also do your final homework in Stata. So in case you will decide to to go for it, you should also go through the Stata course from Moodle. But actually, I really encourage to learn how to code in Stata. It's always nice to have one additional IT skill. And me personally, I really like the graphics in Stata. It really looks nice. So yeah, that's all what I wanted to say.
Thank you. So in general, if there are no questions, I think we can stop here. Yep. So have a nice rest of the week.
Thank you, YouTube.
So should we do the first exercise again?
Well, I don't know, they will have the notes for that. So I'm thinking, won't it be enough?
I believe you can go now. That you don't have to waste your time just hearing me explaining everything again through, so.
Actually, you have asked me to do the backup recording, but when you started to record, then I realized that I cannot record, so I don't have it.
It's the same problem I had that it needs Juha's permission maybe every time. I'm not so sure. Do he have to get that permission every time? But
that was the issue. But yeah, like now you can record it. Okay, then see you next Monday.
Yeah, till next Monday. I'll just go through the first exercise again, and I'll just do it. Do it for the sake of the thing that it is just there. But thank you for your help, and we'll see. We'll see you again next Friday. Then we'll have another demo session again.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So. See you.
So let's continue the recording from here on. So because I forgot to press the recording button, we'll go the first exercise again. So the first exercise is about the validity of the OLS estimation, and we have 5 different equations to go through and think about whether they can be estimated by the OLS. So first of all, the intuition of the OLS is that when you have a scatter plot, think of OLS as a best linear fit in the scatter plot. If there's a positive linear, if the scatter plot is positively associated, meaning that the increase of x-axis is also associated with the increase in the y-axis, and the scatter plot shows this kind of pattern, think of the oval as the linear line going between the scatter plot. So our first equation is perfectly estimated. It looks like the basic textbook OLS equation. But when we are talking about the OLS equation, we have to be sure that our assumptions are also valid, because the results assume the validity of the assumptions. And this means, so let's go through the slides 34 and 35 from the lecture notes to refresh our memory about this assumption. So first of all, the model has to be linear in parameters. Linearity here means the additivity and homogeneity of the degree one. Linearity, additivity is here like, think of A additive B. So these parameters are distinctly additive to the estimation, and the homogeneity of the degree one means that if we multiply the parameter beta by 2, it parallelly affects the u variable by 2. In the classical case, we assume that the parameter is fixed, meaning given from the outside, and it is not varying over time. In a time series, this assumption doesn't usually hold, and coefficients are assumed to be random variables. That means stochastic. And our third, according to our third assumption, is that the estimated value of the error term is zero. And this means basically that on average, the error value of the model is zero. According to our fourth assumption, our variance is constant. And according to this constancy here means that the limits of the variance do not change. And in the fifth assumption, there is no autocorrelation between the error terms, meaning that the errors of the different covariance of the errors of the different periods is zero. Sixthly, there is no multicollinearity, and it means here that there's no perfect linear relationships among the independent variables. Think this way, that you have zeta variable that equals to x1 plus x2. So this means that whenever there's a change in x1 or x2, there's a perfect linear effect to the z variable. This assumption, this cannot be the case with the OLS. And if our model is the true model, meaning that it's the population model, it captures what's going on in the population, there cannot be any specification bias. And the specification bias can arise, for example, from the omitted variables. And then the second equations. Here we have a nonlinear equations. So to make it linear, let's take natural logs. And it results the equation right from the cursor of my mouse. Here we have used the rules of natural logarithms. And since the natural logarithm and the Nieper's number are the inverse operations of each other, that means that when something is multiplied by the inverse, the result is 1. We can cancel it out from our equations, meaning that this here is 1, and this here is 1, and this result in the following equation. And this equation can be perfectly estimated, and usually we are estimating these kind of methods in the following in the first exercise session. Afterwards, there's some minor notes. By applying the rules of the log, you can open this equation. I'll skip it here. In the third equation, we have our parameters are nonlinear. That means that they're multiplied by each other. They don't, these they don't have a linear effect or direct effect to the direct individual effect to the U variable. This means that if we used OLS and that can be done, our effect would represent both of these coefficients and not their in, not them individually. Our fourth equation is the same as the one earlier in 1.2, so it can be estimated, and there's nothing more to add in that equation. The fifth equation will see that we have x multiplied by zeta, and this can be done as this can be thought of as an interaction term. So this means that although the coefficients are linearly independent from each other, the variables can be nonlinear. And then there are some small notes for the OLS. So basically what's OLS is all about, it is just when we are doing research, we can start using the OLS and check what's going on in the data. But when we are doing this, we have to be conscious about the underlying assumptions what we are making, because usually the assumptions of the OLS don't hold. But although they don't hold, this doesn't mean that OLS cannot be useful. It can tell us something or give us hints, but in general, we shouldn't rely on it. And this is the end of the first exercise.